Silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Before we begin today, my notes tell me that Stockbridge High School students may be here today. If they are, and will they and their advisors please stand? Oh, wonderful, wonderful, good group. Thank you very much. You may be seated. The students are here on a program called Courtless Class that we offer in conjunction with the State Bar of Wisconsin. So they've had information about the case that's going to be argued now. If you can remain after this argument is concluded, Justice Rebecca Bradley, who sits down here at the end of the bench, will come out and speak with you and perhaps some other students who were here for the earlier argument this morning. So with those brief preliminaries, counsel, are you ready to begin?
Yes, sir.
Please do.
Chief Justice Rogensack, members of the court, on behalf of myself, my colleague James Goldschmidt, and our client, Alan Yusikantel, thank you for this opportunity to be heard today. I'd like to start, if I could, by at least figuratively transporting us all to Judge Ehler's courtroom in Door County in December of 2015. And remember the situation he faced on that day. He'd set aside 3 hours for an evidentiary hearing in a foreclosure action. A couple weeks prior to this hearing, the property at issue had been the subject of a sheriff's sale. The property is somewhat unique property, 8,700 square foot personal residence, a property that doesn't have a large potential market of buyers. And the only bid at the sheriff's sale was a credit bid by the bank for $2,250,000, which was 45% of the bank's original loan on the mortgage and about 55% of the outstanding balance of the mortgage at the time. The mortgagor was not contesting the foreclosure. The bank had agreed not to seek a deficiency judgment against the mortgagor. But my client, Mr. Yusikantel, the guarantor, was contending that the $2,250,000 credit bid was not an appropriate value to use as a credit against his guarantee. He had witnesses there to prove his point. The bank had witnesses there on the valuation point. The judge also was informed that the bank had, prior to this hearing, commenced an action against Mr. Yusikantel in Florida, where he resides, to execute on any judgment that it received. And Judge Ehlers decided that, and based on a suggestion by Mr. Yusikantel's attorney, that he didn't need to have an evidentiary hearing on the amount of the credit to be applied against Mr. Yusikantel's guarantee in order to make the finding necessary to confirm the sheriff's sale and pass title of the property to the bank, so you didn't have to worry about, you know, additional damage to the property or the bank not being able to get in and have access to the property. But he could separate those two issues, make a decision to confirm the sale, and have the decision made on what value should be credited against the guarantee, either by the federal court in Florida, where the bank had commenced its action, or he made it clear in his order that if, for some reason, the issue came back to him, he would decide it. The first question that you must decide in this appeal is whether Judge Ehlers was wrong when he made that decision.
Your opposing counsel says in brief that Judge Ehlers relied on an unarticulated federal law when he made that decision. Can you articulate what he relied upon when he made that decision?
He relied on Wisconsin law. I think the confusion may come about because there is language in the guarantee that says the guarantee is to be construed by federal law, which, of course, Judge Ehlers could do if necessary.
Judge Ehlers eventually said on the record words to the effect, I do not want to contravene federal law at this time, and so I will not determine the amount of credit to be assigned. So what did he mean by that? Does the record disclose?
Well, I think what he meant by that, and the record we have is, of course, the comments that he made at the hearing, but also the order that he signed ultimately. And the order that he signed was that I decline to proceed to determine value on the guarantee. Not that I cannot or I don't have authority, I don't have the ability, but I decline to do that.
Decline in deference to assign the value. I'm sorry, what?
Let me find the...
Not the credit to be assigned, but the, you said you switched it to value on the guarantee. I didn't follow.
I'm sorry. The order that was signed on January 22nd by Judge Ehlers said that he declined to make a finding of the amount to be credited against the judgment of the bank against Mr. Musicanto. So not that he didn't have the ability or the authority or the jurisdiction to do so, but that he was declining to do so because he was aware of the federal court proceeding. But then he went on to say that he will, if requested by a federal court, make that determination. So that's what he says in the order. And I think to the extent the Court of Appeals felt that he determined he had no authority to make that credit determination, they simply misread both his statements at the hearing and particularly the wording of his order.
When I read all this, I was thinking to myself, well, if the banks bid, and it's not unusual, under these kinds of circumstances where the mortgagee is the only bidder. I mean, that's quite common. And if the $2 million some dollars that the bank bid was the fair market value, was to be determined to be the fair market value, as I'm reading these briefs, I'm thinking to myself, well, what else would the credit possibly be?
Excellent question, and I think it really crystallizes the premise of the Court of Appeals decision and I think of the bank's position in this case. And that premise is that a finding under 846-165 of fair value has to be the same number as a fair value finding for the purposes of applying against a guarantor's credit. And we know that that premise cannot be right under Wisconsin law. It cannot be right for a couple of reasons. The first reason is, what if the bank had proceeded on the foreclosure without joining Mr. Musicanto in this proceeding, which it could have done?
Right. You could have had two separate actions. I think one of the cases referred to Crown Life was two separate actions that we were looking at was the guarantee action.
Exactly. That's my second point. If they had proceeded separately, as they did in Crown Life, there was a determination that the mortgage amount that, or the amount paid against the mortgage debt was fair value for the purposes of confirmation of the sale, and there was cases all say all the court has to decide to make that finding is that there wasn't some sort of mistake that was made in the bidding process, and that the amount doesn't shock the conscience of the court. And remember, it's not a finding in the sense that people are coming in and saying the value should be this, the value should be that. There is already a value set by whatever that sale price is from the sheriff's sale. And again, the only determination the court has to make at that point is, does this shock my conscience or did somebody make a mistake in their calculation? That is different than saying this is the amount that should be applied against the guarantee. And in Crown Life, there's a perfect example of that, where in the confirmation sale, the court said $182,000, if my memory serves me right, was the amount that was credit bid. That was fair value. The sale is confirmed. Then there's the proceeding against the guarantor. The court determines a different amount, a higher amount, as the credit to be applied against the guarantor. And nobody said, well, wait a minute, does that mean that somehow this sale confirmation that occurred months before is invalid or needs to be overturned? No, because it's a determination of two different things.
And well, really, I don't understand really where the bank comes out short either way, because if you have the confirmation taken care of, as the trial court did, then the bank can deal with the property, they can resell it or do whatever they choose to do with it. It's not tied up. And if coming back on the decision about what credit is due on the guarantee, you conclude how much the bank is out, if they're still out as much as they would have been if only $250 had been credited, you're going to be stuck with the same amount. But if, in fact, they turned around and sold the property 2 days later for $7 million, and then maybe there's a different amount that's due on the credit, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
And I think really the
But the bank isn't stuck. They're going to get their money either way.
Right. And I think the crux of what was really happening at the time in front of Judge Ehlers back in 2015, and this is made very clear by the brief submitted by the bank prior to that hearing, is they were taking the position that Judge Ehlers had to make both decisions, the decision about confirming the sale and the amount of credit, at the same time and apply the same shock the conscience standard, which is obviously a very favorable and lenient standard for the bank, but is quite unfair to the guarantor here. I think the McFarland, the State Bank of McFarland case from the Court of Appeals recently talked about what the credit should be is what is the value of the property that the bank has received. That's what the credit should be, and that is a separate determination from whether or not the credit bid by the bank has been sufficient to not shock the conscience of the court for the purposes of the confirmation sale. So,
do you think it's fair to characterize this commercial guarantee as one of payment and performance?
Yeah, I'm sort of confused by the niceties of those, but it says it is a guarantee of payment.
After
the guarantee,
the debtor was in default, could the bank have just proceeded on the guarantee?
It could have. It could have. It chose not to, I assume because it wanted the property, because the property was a very valuable asset.
Would your argument be the same if the bank would have just proceeded against your client on the guarantee?
I wouldn't have the same issue because there wouldn't be the question of what is the value of the property to be credited, because the bank wouldn't be taking possession of the property.
What amount would your client owe under the terms of the guarantee?
My client would owe the $4 million whatever under the terms of the guarantee, but would also have recourse himself against the property, because the property would not have gone over to the bank. But the bank elected not to proceed that way, but instead to proceed against the property and obtain the property.
So what exactly are you seeking?
What I'm seeking is basically an order that says Judge Ehlers was right, and that we need to go back and have a hearing to determine what was the value of that property as of the date of the foreclosure sale, the sheriff's sale, or the confirmation, and that is the amount that should be credited against the guarantee, just as in Crown Life.
Counsel, let's give, for the sake of argument, full marks on the thought that Crown Life says that these two defendants could have been pursued separately, right? There was, however, a stipulation entered into in this case that seems to, at least for some period of time, have joined those two together, because it says the amount paid to plaintiff from the proceeds of said sale of the premises remaining after deduction by plaintiff, blah, 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 is a credit to Mr. Musicanto, right?
Correct.
So at that point, the stipulation appears on its face to have joined the amount of credit to be given to Mr. Musicanto to the fair value determination to be made in the proceedings against the mortgagor.
I do not agree with that.
Okay, tell me
here's why. If you look at the stipulation, particularly paragraph 8 of the stipulation, I think you were quoting from paragraph 11, but paragraph 8 of the stipulation provides that there's going to be the premises are to be sold at a fair and adequate price. Mm-hmm. That's the language of paragraph 8 of the stipulation.
Is that different? Is fair and adequate different from fair value?
Certainly it's different from fair value as that phrase has been interpreted in 846.165 to simply mean something that doesn't shock the conscience of the court. Fair value is used in different statutes, and it can mean different things in different places of the statute. If you have an appraisal action under corporate law, I have some familiarity with that. Fair value has a different meaning than shock the conscience meaning that it applies here.
Right. So it's the term adequate that is key for you.
It's very much a key here. Plus, I would add, Your Honor, that I think the Bank Mutual versus Boyer case and other cases of this court have made clear that Chapter 846 deals with mortgagors and mortgagees. It does not deal with guarantors. It doesn't say anything about guarantors in that statute. And the relationship between a lender and a guarantor is defined by contract. What is the contract of the parties? And here the parties had a contract that said this is how this was going to be determined, and they used the words fair and adequate price in that contract. And so I think that's the terminology that really should apply here to determining this value on the guarantee.
All right. So, and again, just for the sake of argument, let's say that that stipulation did bring together the mortgagor and the guarantor together on the question of fair value and what credit that's going to be. How did it come to be that the circuit court eventually essentially bifurcated those that question and said, you know what, we're going to hold off on the amount of credit to be given to Mr. Musicanto? Was there a motion to that effect? Did the court do that sua sponte? What were the arguments?
I may be a little bit off in the timing, but I think I've got the sequence right here. The sheriff's sale is early November of 2015, I think November 4th. The bank then files a motion seeking confirmation of the sale and indicates in the motion that they will credit the $2,250,000 against the guarantee. Mr. Cano's attorney at the time responded to that, saying, "We have no objection to confirming the sale, Your Honor, but we don't think the $2,250,000 is the right amount of credit, and we contest that." The bank filed a response to that motion saying, no, they have to be decided at the same time, and they have to be the same issue, and we're entitled to this shock the conscience standard. And then there was an argument on the 22nd of December, when the evidentiary hearing was scheduled, where this issue was argued by counsel for both sides, and then Judge Ehlers made the decision that he was going to proceed to confirm the sale, but declined to make a decision on the amount of the guarantee. And obviously, you know, let's see what the federal court does, but saying clearly that if the federal court, for whatever reason, asked him to make that decision, he would come back and make that decision. You know, it may have been that he didn't feel that the 3 hours was going to be sufficient time to even hear all the evidence that would be required to make a decision. And I'm sure that part of the thinking of the judge and all the parties really was nobody benefited from the status of having the confirmation of the sale held up under these circumstances and sort of have this property be in limbo for a longer period of time.
Yeah. So tell me how the stipulation related to that order. Was the stipulation entered into after that hearing and that resulted in the order? How did that happen?
No, the stipulation actually preceded even the sheriff's sale. The stipulation came about shortly after the foreclosure action began, where the bank and the mortgagor and my client, the guarantor, all entered into this stipulation that said, here's how we're going to proceed.
Good. All right. So now at the hearing when that eventually resulted in the order where the court said, we'll deal with the amount of the credit for Mr. Musicanto later, did the parties address the terms of the stipulation in that argument?
I'm not sure I'm tracking your question, but certainly they addressed the terms of the stipulation with respect to confirmation of the sale.
Right, because the bank's argument is, look, all we need to do is look at the stipulation. Those terms control, and that says the proceeds from the sale, and that means the sheriff's sale. So what I'm wondering is, did anybody address that when the hearing was put off? Did someone say, look, you know, the stipulation says X, and so we don't have to put off this hearing. We got the confirmation number already.
Very good question, Your Honor. As I read the brief that was submitted, remember I talked about earlier, the bank actually submitted two briefs before that hearing. And I think in both of those briefs, their argument was simply based on the statute, that this is the way we have to proceed. I didn't see anything in those briefs that referred back to the stipulation as governing this. Now, in the briefs that have been submitted in this court, that is the argument that, as I understand the bank, or one of the arguments the bank is making, that this result is compelled by the stipulation. relying on paragraph 11 of the stipulation. But again, I think the operative paragraph for this purpose is really paragraph 8 of the stipulation that talks about, you know, there will be a sale of the premises at a fair and adequate price. There will be proceeds from that sale, and they will be distributed. And to say that that language can be interpreted to mean that a share of sale, confirmation of a share of sale under this very lenient shock the conscious standard meets what was envisioned by paragraph 8, I just don't see it. I don't think that makes any sense. And the relationship here is governed by this contract.
Isn't this, as the Court of Appeals indicates, a case of just interpreting the stipulation? I mean, isn't that what they did? They didn't touch upon 846.165 at all. They just said, we're going to give full effect to the stipulation entered into by all of the parties here, you know, and emphasize all of the parties here, unlike some later cases where the guarantor was not part of the stipulation.
Certainly that's part of the Court of Appeals rationale, and as I said, I know that's part of the argument the bank is making here, is we're just interpreting the stipulation. But again, I don't think the Court of Appeals even focused on this language in paragraph 8 about what the stipulation really said. What was the contract between the parties? And certainly there's nothing in the stipulation that says that the question of the amount of credit to be given to the guarantor is going to be decided on this very lenient shock the conscience of the court standard that applies in Chapter 846 when there's confirmation of a sale when the bank is not seeking a deficiency judgment. And certainly that was not argued before Judge Ehlers. And if my client had been told, no, if the sale gets confirmed, then that is the amount of money that you're going to be held to in terms of a credit, then he would have acted differently before the judge. He would have put on his evidence there, which is our due process argument.
Touch upon the unjust enrichment or double recovery argument that you advance.
Clear under Wisconsin law that the bank cannot recover twice. So if they get the property, they're only entitled to collect on the guarantee the difference between what they're owed and what the value is of what they've received. And so that's what has to be determined. What is the value of what they've received? What is the value of that property? And our argument simply is you can't take a determination that is made for another purpose, which is this amount so low that it shocks the conscience of the court and we're going to stop a foreclosure sale, to determine that fair value. If you look at the Bank Mutual versus Boyer case, there's a great discussion about the balancing that is in Chapter 846 and what the bank gets and what the mortgagor gets there, and there's a quid pro quo. But what the bank is trying to do here is get that quid, but apply it against a guarantor that isn't getting the benefit of no deficiency judgment that a mortgagor gets under Chapter 846.
So, counsel, of what effect is it that the guarantee calls for Indiana law, or federal law as to the bank, to apply, and you're citing to us with respect to the guarantee Wisconsin law? I get the fact that the foreclosure is subject to Wisconsin procedure, but the substantive law of Indiana, isn't that supposed to, and federal laws to the extent applicable to the lender, supposed to control this issue on the guarantee?
Yes, and when and if there is a hearing on this amount of value, then this choice of law questions, as Judge Ehlers recognized in his order, can be looked at by him, and he can determine is there a difference between Indiana law and Wisconsin law on this, and how does it apply. But the contract between the guarantor, my client, and the bank is what has to be litigated in that second proceeding.
Counsel, you're not saying that the amount of the credit is to be determined after the bank sells the house on the open market, right? You're just saying let's have a fair value hearing where we have appraisers come in and do their contest.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. What happens if the appraisers, if the determination is it's worth $3 million against a debt of $4 million, Bank has the property. They eventually sell it for $5 million.
If there's a fair value determination, that hearing of $3 million, that's what my client is bound by. That's
okay.
You know, I think that's the resulting in Crown Life. But we want our day in court on that issue, and I think we're entitled to it. If I could just very briefly touch on the due process argument, because I wanted to comment on that quickly. Hopefully, we won't need to get there because you will decide to reverse on other grounds. But the argument was made that, well, my client made a tactical litigation decision and ought to be bound by that. But I think the analogy that comes to my mind when I think about the situation here is, let's say I'm a plaintiff and I'm bringing a case, and I say in pretrial proceedings to the trial court judge, Judge, I don't think intent is an element of my claim. And the defendant says, no, I think it is. And the trial judge says, no, I agree with Schott. Intent's not an element of your claim. You don't have to prove that. We proceed to trial. I don't put any evidence in on intent. The Court of Appeals reverses and says, trial court, you're wrong. Intent is an element of your claim. The right result isn't to say, well, Schott, because you didn't put in any evidence on intent, you lose. The right result is to go back and say we have to try the case with intent being an element. And I think that's our argument here on due process, that we really didn't have an opportunity to present, because after the judge made his ruling, we would have looked pretty silly to say, Judge, now that you've made your ruling that we don't have to contest this, we're going to put in evidence on this anyway. I mean, I think, you know, Mr. Nesbitt would have gotten thrown out on his ear if he had tried to do that in front of the judge after, you know, getting a favorable ruling. So that's our argument on due process.
Thank you.
Thank you. I will save my remaining time for rebuttal.
Okay.
You have 5 minutes now and 5 minutes later, too, so you don't have to save anything.
Well, the counsel will, I mean, our timekeeper will keep track of all its time, so you'll get what was left over and your 5 minutes for rebuttal, whatever that is. I don't keep it here. Our marshal keeps it, so. 4 minutes more. Okay.
4 seconds.
Oh, 4 seconds? Okay. Pretty close. Pretty close. Okay. Are you prepared to proceed? Yeah, please do.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Melinda Bialzik. I am with Conor Mann and Kalis, and we represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, Horizon Bank. The Court of Appeals in this case correctly enforced an unambiguous stipulated judgment between the parties. And that's a stipulation and a judgment to which Mr. Musakanto freely agreed. For whatever reason, Mr. Musakanto apparently regretted his choice to stipulate to that judgment and is now trying to avoid the judgment by ignoring the fact that there is a judgment in place to which he stipulated and making some misplaced policy arguments. But policy arguments support upholding the Court of Appeals decision. Not only because the parties stipulated to this result, but also because the procedure that the parties agreed to in that stipulated judgment, that is the correct procedure under Wisconsin law for determining and applying a credit to a guarantee like the one at issue here.
Is that the right credit? That the guarantee could have been sued upon separately as it was in Crown Life?
Absolutely.
Okay, so it was the bank's choice to bring a complaint that brought both a foreclosure action ending up in a confirmation of sale and a guarantee enforcement in the same action.
Absolutely.
Okay, and if you had brought them separately, where would we be today on the guarantee?
Well, I think it might depend on the specific facts of that guarantee and in particular the terms of the guarantee.
Well, we have the guarantee. It was in the record. So
correct.
We'll use the one we have.
If we assume the guarantee in this case, I think the guarantee in this case, as do many, waives all defenses of the guarantor to defenses of impairment of collateral. Now, the guarantor is, of course, entitled to a credit for proceeds actually received by a lender from any source, mm-hmm. liquidation of any collateral, a payment made. And so if there were a confirmed foreclosure sale and the bank received the proceeds of that sale, whether cash from a cash
No,
buyer,
I'm sorry. I didn't make a very good question.
Sorry.
I want you to take the hypothetical that you didn't join these two together.
Correct.
Instead, you proceeded on the guarantee. Where would you be?
Oh, without ever proceeding. Well, I think the bank would be entitled to fully collect on the amounts due from the guarantor.
Okay, and what would happen to the real estate?
Well, I understand that under equitable subrogation, the guarantor would have rights to step into the shoes of the bank at that point and
okay.
could proceed.
And so the guarantor could then proceed and sell the real estate for whatever the guarantor could get out of it, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so it's still we would still look at the amount the guarantor had to pay under the guarantee as reduced by whatever the value of the real estate was that was received, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So in that situation, if the property is really worth more than $250,000, the guarantor would have come out much better than where you're putting him in this situation, correct?
Well, the value that the bank receives is the foreclosure bid, confirmed bid price.
Confirmation of sale is a very different procedure. It's a statutory procedure governed by statute, and the rules are governed. What I proposed to you first is to proceed under common law, under the guarantee, and I agree with your result. What would happen is the guarantor would have to pay whatever is still due under the note that he guaranteed, but the guarantor would get the property, and then the guarantor could realize on the value of the property. He could sell it to whomever he wanted, and if he got no more than $250,000, he'd be in the same spot that he is right now, but he'd have the ability to get the full value of the property. The reason we're here today is the proceeding you want to use shuts the guarantor from receiving the full value of the property because you chose to bring two actions together, correct?
Well, the guarantor would step into the shoes of the bank, meaning it could begin its own foreclosure proceedings.
Of course.
So the property would still have to be sold pursuant to a foreclosure sale. Now, if the guarantor wanted to come in and be the high bidder, the guarantor could do that in the bank's foreclosure
The guarantor sale. Could realize, I mean, you have a sophisticated guarantor.
Correct.
Okay, so he's not going to sell the property for the smallest amount possible. And all he is arguing to us is that he wants the right to have the value of the property credited against what he owes. And he hasn't had his day in court to do that because at the proceeding, it was deferred. Okay, so the circuit court decided, well, you've got two separate actions. The guarantor is arguing that he doesn't want to have the value determined. And if you're going to determine it today, I've got my witness here. I'm ready to go. And it seems to me that there was an agreement among all the parties, the bank was at this hearing too, to go forward without making a determination of what is the full value of the property, because the trial court in its order specifically said it was not going to make that determination today. So I have trouble with your stipulation argument when everybody's standing in court and this is where they end up.
I don't think that's a fair characterization of what happened, Your Honor. Okay. I think, in fact, the bank invited Mr. Musakantow to present whatever evidence he believed he had on this issue, and in fact, the court did make a determination as to the value of this property. For a property to be sold in every instance through a sheriff's sale, which is what was happening here, the court has to make a finding of fair value, and it has to make that finding whether it's sold to a third party for cash, whether it's sold to a bank for a credit bid.
But we are talking past each other because you're talking about fair value and a confirmation sale. I agree with everything you said. The question is that the same number as the value to be placed against a guarantee?
Yes, because a guarantor is only entitled to receive what the bank, as a credit, what the bank actually receives from the proceeds of a liquidation of collateral.
What about if this had, if you had brought this action separately, as they did in the Crown case, you wouldn't be making this argument to us.
I would be making this argument. It is true that in the Crown Life case, there was apparently, for some reason, a different amount determined. But Crown Life didn't explain why that happened, and the Supreme Court did not say that that was a proper procedure for any reason. In fact, it specifically said that issue and the fact that that had happened wasn't in front of it.
Can you refresh my recollection in Crown Life if there was a choice of law provision that was different from the law of the state of Wisconsin? And to what extent does the provision in this guarantee choosing federal law as to the lender and Indiana law as to the provisions of the guarantee, does that make any difference in your argument? Because I don't hear people arguing Indiana law here.
I don't believe anyone is arguing Indiana law anymore.
Are we just pretending that provision in the guarantee doesn't exist? I have been a lawyer on cases where, for example, New York law was the law that was agreed to. New York law is very different than Wisconsin law on particular issues. It made the date for our particular case. I don't know Indiana law, but Indiana law applies as to the guarantee. Procedurally, as to the foreclosure, Wisconsin law applies. So to what extent does the stipulation conform to the Wisconsin foreclosure proceeding, and to what extent is the guarantee still out there as to whatever Indiana or federal law might be?
The guarantee is not still out there because the party stipulated to a judgment.
And in a foreclosure or in the...
For everything, for the claim. Remember,
so where did the court make... I thought the court... Didn't I read somewhere the court specifically left out and said the procedure here is foreclosure in Wisconsin. The guarantee is driven by federal law as to the lender and I think Indiana law, right?
Yes, but that the court was mistaken there, and here's why. The court had already entered a judgment on the claims of the guarantee. The judgment was entered, and that judgment stated that the judgment was for the full amount, for $4 million.
The bank on the foreclosure.
On the guarantee as well. The court, the bank brought separate actions and combined them in one proceeding.
Okay.
But the stipulated judgment addressed all claims. And so there was, in fact, a judgment against Mr. Musicanto that was entered by the court for $4 million. What happened afterward was there was a confirmation of share of sale, and the stipulation had provided that the proceeds of that sale would be credited against the judgment. So we're now after the judgment. We're looking at proceedings after the judgment was entered. And so the guarantee has been merged into that judgment at this point. And Mr. Musicanto really, although he made those arguments in front of the circuit court, all that did was, about Indiana law, all that did was to confuse the circuit court as to what it was and was not permitted to do. In fact, he hasn't made any argument that Indiana law or federal law would require some different result here. All of the briefs in front of this court, we're only talking about Wisconsin law for good reason, because what we're looking at here is Wisconsin law, because there is a judgment in place.
There is also an order that came about after the judgment, entered the 22nd day of January 2016, correct?
Correct.
And in that order, the court specifically defers making a decision on what amount should be credited against the guarantee, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So why is it that we should ignore that order?
We're not ignoring that order. I think the court was confused as to what was, and I think the Court of Appeals was correct, that the court was confused as to what the choice of law provision in the original guarantee, what effect it had, because it didn't have any effect at this point. We have a judgment in place. The parties stipulated to a judgment on the claims that were based on the original guarantee. So now we're to the stage where we're determining the credit that Mr. Musicanto is due.
That you can get a judgment on a guarantee for the amount due under the loan. That was my understanding of what the judgment was. Anything that hadn't been paid under the loan was a judgment against the guarantor, correct?
Correct.
But that doesn't say anything about what kind of a credit, when you realize on the guarantee, should be applied against that judgment. And I think you agree there had to be a credit against that judgment.
Of course there did. And there would have been a credit against the judgment, even as you pointed out earlier, if these had been separate proceedings. They could have obtained the judgment against Mr. Musicanto, and either before or while attempting to collect on it, they could have foreclosed on the real property.
Right.
And when they eventually got a foreclosure sale and a confirmed bid price as fair value, they would have been required to credit that against Mr. Musicanto's original judgment.
Well, certainly they would have been required to credit that amount, but I think there's a separate question that's being argued here, and is there an avenue to contest that is not the correct amount to credit against the guarantee? Seems to me that's what the opposing side of this, you're saying, oh, that's it, no more, we can't think about it anymore because we've already had a foreclosure proceeding. But the foreclosure proceeding doesn't say a word about a guarantee, not a word. So if we're going to use this opportunity to clarify the law, if there's some confusion here, I suggest that we look at the question that's being argued, which is not that the bank doesn't have a right to a judgment against the guarantor, but what is the opportunity for the guarantor to proceed upon showing what should be the accurate credit against that guarantee? The bank isn't going to lose either way. I mean, if you let them go and they come out with a hearing and all they get there is a value of $250,000, you're where you are. If, in fact, the bank has realized on this piece of property for a ton more, say $7 million, then there might be a little bit of a dispute about what the value is.
Well, but I think the McFarland State Bank case makes it clear that it's not appropriate to consider what's happened to the property after the fact.
And I agree with that. It should be the value on the date. I agree with you.
And the value on the day, and again, if the bank sold this to a third-party bidder, the bank would receive cash, and that would be the amount that it was applying to the credit. And there's nothing in the foreclosure statutes that distinguishes between a credited and a cash bid. It is the same fair value determination that a court has to reach in order to confirm this.
I don't disagree with your knowledge of the law on foreclosure. I mean, you're reading the statute as it's been read for years, and I agree with you. I just think there's a different question that somehow we're not communicating about. And it's not that the bank doesn't have a right to the amount, to a judgment against a guarantor. And this is a guarantee of payment and performance. It's a very broad guarantee. And what is being argued on the other side is, yes, you have your judgment. Yes, you've gotten your foreclosure. Now you can deal with the property, and we didn't tie it up. But we want our opportunity to argue the amount that you got as a fair value in confirmation is not necessarily the same amount that should be credited against the guarantee. That's the argument that's being made.
But would we be having the same argument if the property were sold for a cash bid and the fair value confirmed amount is the actual dollar amount, not a piece of property, that the court, well, that the bank
received? You may be. You may be right.
I think
they still want their day in court upon how to be able to determine the amount, the value of the property for purposes of the guarantee.
I thought I heard you answer the Chief Justice's question earlier. I might be mistaken. But I thought your response earlier was that the answer to her question lies in the terms of the stipulation that was entered in. And I got to tell you, I didn't quite follow the details, if that was your response. I didn't quite follow the details of your response. So am I right that your answer to her question is, look, there was a stipulation here that they're bound by, and so therefore, whether in a normal case where there's no stipulation, no such stipulation, there is a forum to contest the amount of credit for purposes of the guarantor, that's an interesting question, but here we have a stipulation that answers that. Was that your answer earlier?
I think that is absolutely correct, Your Honor. And okay. I think that's what the Court of Appeals did and why the Court of Appeals didn't get to these additional questions, because it didn't need to. Because the stipulated judgment, it reduced the party's claims to a judgment against Mr. Musacanto of $4 million and then provided for the procedure for crediting that judgment from, and it was very clear and unambiguous, the proceeds of the sheriff's sale.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Counsel, you used the term clear and unambiguous, and in your first couple of sentences of your argument today, you also advanced that the stipulation in relevant part is clear and unambiguous. And one of the first things that I do in preparing for oral argument is read the Court of Appeals opinion. And at the outset of the Court of Appeals opinion, it quotes, I think, paragraph whatever the paragraph is, perhaps paragraph 11 of the order. And I read this before I get to the briefs. This is how I prepare. And I looked at, in their paragraph 5, they've set forth the stipulation, which is, as I said, I think paragraph 11 of the order. And when I read that, I said to myself, well, this is ambiguous. And let me tell you why I thought it was ambiguous, and then you can correct me and enlighten me why I'm wrong. I looked at the very last phrase of the quoted excerpt of paragraph 11, which is, shall be credited by the bank as payment on said monetary judgment. And it doesn't say as payment of said monetary judgment. It says as payment on it. And I thought of people making payments on their account. You know, I mean, you pay it towards your account. And so that's the way that I interpreted it. It was unclear to me, quite frankly, how to interpret it. Shall be credited by Horizon Bank as payment on said monetary judgment, or as payment of said monetary judgment, or as payment, you know. I thought the question was left begging, so to speak. Was this to be the full thing, payment of it, or was it payment on it, akin to payment toward it? Help me with this.
Payment toward it. And I don't think any party has disputed that that was the intention of the parties when they said payment on it. I think Your Honor's first gut instinct on this was correct. And Mr. Musicanto never argued that the fact of a confirmed share of sale meant that his entire judgment would be credited and deemed satisfied. And that's why it's so important. It's the proceeds of the share of sale. So the amount that's received by the bank, which is the amount of the confirmed credit bid, shall be credited toward his money judgment.
But then there may be other credit.
Absolutely. If the bank had other collateral and went out and liquidated that collateral,
okay,
it would be required to credit Mr. Musicanto for that. If somehow the debtor made payments against the original debt, which is unlikely to happen after they would be required to give credit for all payments received on the debt from any source.
Well, this doesn't quite say what you're saying. It may mean it, but it doesn't quite say it. And it seems to me, again, it leaves open-ended. This is payment toward, you're saying. Okay, good. That's why I focus on the on rather than of. This is payment toward it, shall be credited. It doesn't address what other credits. You've outlined some of the other credits. Why does your argument refuse to acknowledge that credit can also be obtained by an evidentiary hearing and showing what is the fair value and getting credit in that manner? Why are the manners of getting additional credit toward the monetary judgment exclusive to the ways you are advancing?
Because what the bank receives here is, I mean, what this paragraph is talking about is proceeds from the sale of the property. And the bank receives those proceeds once. It receives either cash if the property is sold to a third party, or it receives the property if it's the credit bidder. And as McFarland State Bank instructs, you know, that confirmed share of sale is the appropriate value of the property at the moment the title passes to the bank, because now the collateral is disposed of and the mortgage is lifted, and that's what the bank receives. So I don't think there's any basis, certainly not in the stipulation, but I don't think otherwise at law, to suggest that then there's some additional amount that the guarantor would be entitled to. I mean, certainly the debtor wouldn't have any position to argue if there were deficiency judgment that proceeds, again, whether cash or not, isn't the right amount for its deficiency judgment. And keep in mind, this word proceeds, it's the same exact phrase that's in 846.04, which talks about the mechanism for determining deficiency judgment. And this stipulated judgment resolved all of the parties' claims. It resolved the foreclosure claims. It resolved the claims against Mr. Musicanto. And it was entered into by all parties, represented by counsel. They picked these words, which are the same words as are in the statute for deficiency judgments. I don't think there's any fair reading of this stipulated judgment other than it was intended to work the same way the foreclosure statutes work, in terms of proceeds are proceeds, and there's no distinguishing between cash and a credit bid, and that is the correct amount that should be credited to Mr. Musicanto. And he absolutely had an opportunity in this case to challenge the amount of the credit bid. In fact, Horizon Bank, even at that final hearing, did not want the court to do what it did. He wanted Mr. Musicanto to provide his evidence. But even if Mr. Musicanto had...
Counsel, since we're turning back to that question, I'd like to tweak the hypothetical offered by the Chief Justice just a bit and see what you'd do with it. Let's say the actions were brought seriatim, and you started with the foreclosure, and you proceeded entirely through the foreclosure. You get the judgment foreclosure. There's the sheriff's sale. you get the confirmation of the sheriff's sale for 2.225, right? Now you go after the guarantor. Is the confirmed sale price conclusive against the guarantor as far as the credit that he is to have?
I think likely it would be. I mean, absent some showing of...
Without him having an opportunity to contest that.
It may depend on the terms of his guarantee, frankly.
Let's say it's the guarantee that's at issue in this case. Does he have an opportunity under that scenario to contest the credit amount?
Under the guarantee here, Mr. Mustacanto waived all defenses of impairment of collateral. He doesn't have a right to challenge the manner in which the bank disposes of collateral.
It's not a question of impairment of collateral. It's a question of how much credit does he get against the judgment.
Well, the confirmation, the confirmed bid price, is the amount that's received by the bank when it liquidates that collateral. And again, whether it's cash bid or not, that
right.
confirmed
so,
price.
So the key here is to find something that ties that confirmed value to the guarantee proceedings, right? And let me give you just a little hint where I'm going with this. 846.165 sub 2 says the confirmed value is a credit against the mortgage debt.
Correct.
Right? Doesn't say anything about a guarantee.
Correct.
All right. And we know that the guarantee is an entirely separate contractual obligation from the mortgage guarantee.
Or correct.
From the mortgage and the note, right?
Correct.
Okay. So is it your position that not being a party to the foreclosure proceedings, the confirmed value is conclusive with respect to an unrelated contractual obligation?
Again, not the facts of our case, but I think that it absolutely could be.
Okay, what's the could part?
Well, again, absent something in the guarantee that was different, absent some argument. I mean, a guarantor always has, for example, an argument that a bank proceeded in bad faith, so if it showed the foreclosure proceedings were not properly conducted because of the bank, absent some sort of circumstance like that.
Okay, so here's the crux I want to get to, what I want to hear you say or deny, that the guarantor either has a right or does not have a right to contest the credit amount when the bank proceeds against him on the guarantee.
If it is not part of the foreclosure proceedings, and so he's
yes.
not a party to those proceedings.
Correct.
I don't think it's raised by our facts. I don't think he would.
Okay.
Because he is, just like any collateral that the bank liquidates and receives value for, receives money for, he's entitled to a credit for that. But unless he's challenging the manner in which the bank liquidated it, which he's not entitled to do under the terms of his guarantee, challenging the amount the bank receives if it believes, and again, even if we had a third-party cash bid, if he believes that wasn't enough, that's really a defensive impairment of collateral that the bank, you know, permitted this property to be disposed of for too little. But that's not part of, that's something that he's waived in his guarantee. He doesn't have those defenses under the terms of his specific guarantee.
Counsel, what do we make of the court's specific finding? I am not making a finding as to the appropriate credit against the guarantee under the language of the commercial guarantee that is governed by federal law. What does that mean?
That I think what it means is that the court was confused. I think the court, again, we have a judgment, so we're no longer looking at the guarantee. But I also think that the court was simply confused and was finding that somehow some unidentified federal law was and some other venue was more appropriate, and that I think the court also said, I'm not going to preempt federal law. I don't know what the court meant by that, because certainly the Wisconsin court acting here was not preempting any federal law. It was simply enforcing the terms of the judgment and determining the credit. So I think what that means is that the court was confused and made that ruling an error.
Well, but it was the confirmation of sale.
Correct.
In the foreclosure.
Correct.
Where the court made that determination.
Yes.
Where did the court make that determination in the guarantee lawsuit, portion of this lawsuit?
Mr. Mustacanto never raised that issue, and instead he stipulated to judgment. So the time for him to have argued that some different law applied would have been in the defense of the bank's claims against him under the guarantee. Instead, he stipulated to judgment.
Throughout the whole confirmation of sale proceeding, though, that was the argument they were going back and forth on. You can do this in the foreclosure. But when it comes to the guarantee, Indiana and federal law apply. And that continually was referenced. And then the court concludes it with saying, you know, I'm not deciding the guarantee credit.
And
so
Mr.
where
Mr.
is the, I hear you say it's clear and it's unambiguous and it's clear it was decided and it's clear it was stipulated to. When I read the transcript, it's not so clear to me, especially when you have the court saying, hey, I'm not deciding that. So where is it so clear? Help me out with that.
There was no other law that should have been applied here. There was a judgment in place. And Mr. Misticanto made some arguments about some other law.
So are there other?
He's abandoned those arguments. He's no longer arguing that there's a different standard out there from some different jurisdiction or law, legal body that should be applied.
Well, they were, I mean, this wasn't something that just was a one-liner. This was kind of throughout the entire proceeding. Are there other parts of the guarantee where we should strike certain lines of it?
The guarantee is merged into the judgment. So whatever the terms of the guarantee are, it's the judgment we're looking at now.
Well, what parts are enforceable and what aren't, then, if we're going to excise the Indiana law and federal law part?
I'm not saying we're excising only parts of the guarantee. What I'm saying is if he wanted to raise defenses about interpretation of the guarantee, he needed to do that as part of his defense of the claims by Horizon Bank against him. He didn't. He didn't raise any of those. Instead, he stipulated to judgment. So those defenses related to the specific language of the guarantee are no longer valid because there is no longer a guarantee that's controlling. There's a judgment that's controlling.
But what about when you have the trial court judge saying, I have a foreclosure, I have a guarantee action. Right now, I'm dealing with the confirmation of sale in the foreclosure. I know you've started a lawsuit in Florida dealing with the other issues. I know that's been pending since November 16. I'm having my hearing here on December 22. I'm not deciding that issue. That's the right place for that. In fact, I'm specifically going to tell you I'm not deciding that.
That was an error, and Horizon Bank argued to the circuit court that it shouldn't be making that determination, that it should go ahead, that it was required to apply the fair value confirmed price as the credit amount. And the fact that Mr. Misticanto was able to confuse the circuit court and induce its error is, again, another reason why there's no reason to have him have a do-over here and get to do this again. He chose a litigation strategy, which was to make an argument that confused the circuit court and induced it to commit error. He chose not to present evidence on the actual issue of whether or not $2.25 million represented fair value. The court determined that $2.25 million represented fair value based on the evidence that was in the record in front of it, which amply supported that conclusion by the court. The court determined fair value, and that is the value that was received by the bank from the proceeds of the share of sale under the stipulated judgment. That is the amount that has to be applied as credit to Mr. Misticanto's money judgment.
In a court of equity, why is it here that there isn't a due process right of some sort of the guarantor to provide evidence of fair value? And if the whole argument of due process right to provide fair value, could you respond to that?
Horizon Bank never objected to Mr. Misticanto presenting whatever he claimed his evidence was. In fact, they invited him to do so. At the hearing, they agreed to continue the original hearing to give him a full 3 hours to present whatever evidence he thought he had. Instead, at that second hearing, he came up with a new argument. He decided to bring up these choice of law issues, which were really red herrings, and confuse the court, but he had every opportunity to present the evidence. He chose not to.
Thank you. You could start by using your 4 seconds and then get into your
yeah,
I think
right.
I already have. I guess where I would like to start is taking another crack at the question, and I can't frankly remember who asked me, but it was the question of what are we looking for here? Because I think I gave an original answer that was very focused on the relief that I'm seeking for my client in this action. But I know that in addition to just deciding this case, one of the things that you're all thinking about is what does this mean for foreclosure law and guarantor law in Wisconsin. And I think what we're looking for here is two things. One, a decision that says the question of fair value under 846.165 for the purpose of confirming a share of sale is a different issue than the issue of what credit a guarantor gets when property transfers in that way. Those are just, they're just two separate issues, they're two separate standards, and they need to be decided separately. And secondly, if a bank or a lender chooses to bring two actions together, both the action against the original mortgagor and the action against the guarantor, the trial court has some discretion in determining how it's going to decide those two issues. Maybe it makes sense to decide them both at the same time in the same hearing with the same evidence. Maybe it makes sense to decide one first and decide the other one second. Maybe it makes sense, as it did to Judge Ehlers here, to say there's another proceeding someplace else that's already looking at this second question, and so I'm going to handle it that way. So I think that makes sense, and I think it avoids this sort of parade of horribles that we saw in the bank's brief about how this would be throwing a monkey wrench into Wisconsin law. I don't think that what I've outlined throws any kind of a monkey wrench into Wisconsin law. I think it's a very workable framework, a very sensible framework, and treats everybody fairly. As, you know, the comment about these foreclosure proceedings being equitable proceedings, I think, is one that we shouldn't lose here. That really is what this is all about, and is fairness. And it is fair to say we're going to confirm a sheriff's sale on the basis of a it doesn't shock the conscience of the court standard, when as part of that you're also saying, and the person that is affected by that, the mortgagor, we're not going against you for any kind of a deficiency. That is fair.
And counsel, but at that point, so the bank says you don't have a contractual right to contest the amount of the credit, because that falls into the category of impairment of collateral. What about that? Does this fall into the category of impairment of collateral?
No, it does not. Impairment of collateral is if you, you know, somehow let damage occur to the property or something like that. I don't think that's impairment of the collateral at all. It is a question of the value of that property and what value should be determined as the credit against the guarantee. So, you know, I think this is all very consistent with the whole policy behind Chapter 846, which is in the foreclosure context to, you know, allow speedy confirmations of sales when there's a decision made to forgive the deficiency judgment, and then deal with the guarantee issue within the discretion of the trial court how best to deal with it. And, you know, we have very experienced judges in our trial courts that can figure out, you know, am I going to do this all at the same time? This was an unusual situation in that you had a piece of property that, you know, doesn't have a big market. There are not a lot of potential buyers out there, and so that, you know, maybe influenced Judge Ehlers' discretion in a way that would be different than in a more typical situation where this comes up.
Let's make this a little bit more unusual. Let's say the bank was seeking a deficiency judgment. The confirmation occurs, and then Mr. Musicantel stands up and says, okay, now it's my turn to contest the amount of credit. And he puts on his evidence, and he gets a larger credit than the mortgagor did. What do we do with that?
I think his guarantee is governed by his contract. If he gets a larger credit, he gets a larger credit. I mean, that's binding against the bank in that instance. So,
rather than something unusual, I want to do bread and butter, and that is these guarantees are done by, you know, parents, Aunt Mildred's, all sorts of relatives and friends. How does your rule play out for what I would think are the majority of guarantees in foreclosure actions because it's residential, you know, home property?
I think what I propose makes eminent sense in those types of situations because, again, if the mortgagor is not going to be stuck with a deficiency judgment, so if, you know, I'm guaranteeing the debt of my child isn't going to have a deficiency judgment, having the title to the property pass and having that confirmed may make some sense, but that shouldn't affect my right to be able to come in and say, hey, wait a minute, that property was worth more than the credit bid of the bank. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you both very much. It's a really, really interesting case. It's the kind of law that I did lots of before I became a judge, but I don't think I've seen these kinds of arguments made before. So thank you very much. The briefs were very good and very helpful, and the argument was most important. We are going to adjourn for a lunch break, and we'll reconvene for our third case at 1:30. We are adjourned.